Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor, as today we talk about the management of ovarian cancer with Dr. Bradley Monk, who's now the medical director of the late phase research program with the Florida Cancer Specialists and Research Institute. He's also, of course, vice president and member of the board of directors of the GOG Foundation and co-director of GOG Partners. We have a great faculty. This is actually our fourth program in this series and final one. Later on in the program, you'll see a survey of the investigators of their usual treatment practices. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we do in all of our webinars, there's a one-minute pre-meeting and then post-meeting survey for you to take in the chat room. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of the meeting here tonight. We'll be back on Thursday to do begin our year in review series. We're doing a whole bunch of these over the next couple months. We're going to start out with a hormone receptor positive breast cancer. It's coming off the San Antonio breast cancer meeting in the last December. And so we'll start that this Thursday. And then we'll go on out to San Francisco for the ASCO GI meeting. We're doing three seminars there. One on Thursday, the 18th, and these will all be simulcast virtually. So we're doing one on gastroesophageal cancers, Thursday the 18th. Friday, we'll be talking about colorectal cancer. Saturday, hepatobiliary cancers. Next week, they've got ASCO GU 2 weeks in a row. So we'll hit to that too. We're doing a couple of programs there. One on the prostate cancer, and then another one on bladder cancer. And then in March, we're going to be doing a weekend full of oncology. We're working with a Florida cancer specialist, as we've been doing the last 15 years, and so happy to see Brad coming on. We have 31 investigators coming to Miami to cover, I think, 25 different tumor types. It should be a great weekend there. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including the recent program we did with Dr. O'Malley on ovarian cancer. But today we're here to talk about ovarian cancer in terms of what's new, what's come, particularly what's coming along in the future. As always, we will be referring to some off-label uses of medication. We're really here to try to dissect out the risk-benefit approach to discuss with patients. As we always do, we have some docs in practice, both gynecologic oncologists and medical oncologists, to present cases here today. We're going to start out with a little bit of introduction, then we'll talk about some cases, we'll show you the results of the faculty survey, and then we'll go through a bunch of papers that Brad has done. So Brad, wow, I was really surprised to see this announcement, but so happy after working with you for so many years and Florida Cancer Specialists to see you're getting together. We already have Dr. Patel there in the early phase one, you're going to be late phase. Any thoughts as you embark on this exciting adventure?
It is exciting, and thank you. It's good to join you in Florida. I think you're in Miami, but this is exciting for me. I enjoy clinical research, as everyone knows, and I've been focused on GYN, but also dabbled in other tumor types. So this is a medical directorship to communicate with physicians, to work on our operations, and just to continue to grow the program in a relevant way. We have to be relevant when we do clinical trials, and I'm just excited to be here. I have a lot to learn, and I'll be living in West Palm Beach, but it's a statewide position, and I will continue to see patients here.
So, yeah, looking forward to seeing you for the weekend and with the group there. A couple of papers I pulled, I want to get your thoughts on related to, you know, what's happening in clinical research in ovarian cancer. And, of course, this is a great review article talking about platinum-resistant ovarian cancer, such a bugaboo. And we could spend an hour just talking about your paper and all the trials that you discuss in the paper. Anything you want to say in general about the issue of platinum-resistant disease and some of the strategies you think will be interesting to look at over the next few years?
Yeah, thank you for that, Neil. So it's pretty common to bring medications in later lines of therapy where patients have limited treatment options. And that's certainly been the tradition in ovarian cancer where platinum is no longer active, what we call platinum-resistant recurrent ovarian cancer, patients that recur in less than 183 days or 6 months. The challenge has been that most of our studies have been negative, been very disappointing. 2014, as you recall, we got bevacizumab approved with three single agent chemotherapies, weekly paclitaxel, liposomal doxorubicin, topotecan. And then we went about 0 for 20, okay? And then we hit Mirasol. And Mirasol, the antibody-drug conjugate, we might have an opportunity to talk about folate receptor alpha and how the antibody-drug conjugate gained accelerated approval and then was confirmed and is now published in the New England Journal. So that was important because we can win. We were thinking maybe we couldn't. The purpose of this paper by Ramez Iskander, who I'm very proud of, he was one of my fellows, is learn the lessons. Learn the lessons from the failure and sort of get, you know, better, more efficient. Try to de-risk the studies. I'm afraid that there are studies commonly like these, Forward One and Mirror, Forward One, which you see at the top. There was no phase two. There was a single arm. You had shown Javelin 200 with avelumab. There was no phase two. So we don't really have the time to take 2 years to do a phase two. But we also shouldn't jump into a phase three. We need to de-risk that through early surrogates of activity, okay, through interim analyses and so on. And that's really the key take-home message. Number one, that you can win. But number two, we have to learn from our mistakes. We need to de-risk these large phase three trials that don't have a phase two proof of concept.
So we also asked the faculty what kind of strategies they're most interested in seeing developed in new clinical trials. And you mentioned IO, pembrolizumab, ADCs, of course, I feel like we talk about constantly. Relacorilant, you might want to comment out. Nemvaleukin, aflibercept, and of course, novel CTLA-4 antibodies. Before you make whatever comments you want about what you're most excited about, Alma in the chat room wants to know where you see trials heading for cellular therapy in ovarian cancer, and I'll add bispecifics on top of that. We're starting to see that now in solid tumors. We've seen it a lot in heme tumors, of course.
We are. So BMS, you know, has a MUC16 bispecific in ovarian cancer, the proof of principle. We see CRS like you see it. That's a challenge. Cellular therapies in all solid tumors have been very challenging. I think you're familiar with the Iovance opportunity, which is before the FDA and checkpoint exposed melanoma, which is now on clinical hold because they had a grade 5 toxic death in their lung cancer study. So that was a real setback. They also have had some potency issues. In other words, are these tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes that they resect and reinfuse after marrow conditioning chemotherapy, are they really tumor-specific or are they just sort of in the tumor? That's what we call potency. So we have a lot of work to do. We're trying to learn about CAR T cells. We do a study with MAGE-A4 as a target that's HLA-restricted by a company called Adaptimmune. That's probably the leading ovarian cancer cellular therapy in development. I just want to say here, it's ADCs, and of course, we can study ADCs, and let's not forget ADCs. And so you see, you know, TROP2 is coming. You see more folate receptor alphas beyond mirvetuximab. The problem or challenge with mirvetuximab is 2/3 of the patients don't have folate receptor alpha high. Okay, we see medications such as Sutro, Profound Bio got fast track today. BMS also has one with farletuzumab and their eribulin. NaPi2b, despite what happened to Mersana, is being recycled. And obviously you have HER2 and on and on and on. So those other agents, we have novel IO combinations. We have AKT, efruxifertib you mentioned. So combinations with PARP, very challenging. Combinations with IO, very challenging. ADCs.
So we got a question from Saurabh in the chat room. It's got asking about the Kellum score. I'm just going to hold on to that for a second until we get to your papers on that. One. I just learned about that doing this series when we were doing the first one with Katie Moore. So anyhow, we'll get to that in a second. But I want to also move into the case and get a little clinical here. And we're going to start out with a patient of Dr. Schneider. This is a woman who's 48, and actually she was initially managed in, I think it was Los Angeles, Dr. Schneider's in North Carolina, got transferred over to her, and she got this story, which she was that this patient had stage 2 disease, was germline BRCA1, but just got surgery and chemotherapy, not PARP, and then, as you'll hear, then moved and then presented to Dr. Schneider. Here's the case.
Unfortunately, her CA-125 began to elevate very rapidly, and we got a PET scan showing a single intensely FDG avid implant and the umbilicus, as you can see there. The rest of her PET scan was negative, so we did resect it. Margins were negative. And my question now for this patient was, would anybody recommend chemo? So she had a very, very tough time with her original chemotherapy, barely got through it, and has some residual neuropathy despite her young age. I did recommend chemotherapy. I discussed doing a shortened course, but my other question, would anybody just consider a PARP inhibitor at this point with an isolated recurrence that was completely resected?
Could you feel the nodule?
You could not. As you can tell, it's a little deep and it's right below her belly button. She was a little fluffy.
So any thoughts about the case?
So, Kelly, I know her. She's wonderful. It's good to see her in here. She's fantastic.
She is.
So the first message is, even today, so SOLO-1 was FDA approved, all BRCA patients, germline somatic 2018. 6 years later, not all patients are still getting PARP. Second point, the stage 2 patient technically was not eligible for that, but still has a risk of recurrence higher than 50%. So the need is unmet, and the efficacy is proven. So, you know, there are people that are a little bit too robotic. Most of us would recommend a PARP inhibitor for the stage 2 patient. Now, there might be a reimbursement issue. I would fight them with this high risk of recurrence and for this obvious indication. Second, you know, I applaud her sensitivity to the patient experience. Yes, chemotherapy should be given, but we have to be sensitive to the patient experience. Fourth, it should be resected. It's easy to resect. The resection decision is based on complexity, the number of lesions. If they're hard to remove, they can, you know, be radiated. This is a relatively simple skin operation. What's done next, obviously, is not informed by clinical trials. Yes, she needs treatment. And it's shared decision-making, as you obviously hear that trite saying. I probably would just give her PARP inhibitor. And that's what she wants to do. You can sort of feel that. And it would sort of be on label. It's treatment now. So treatment still it's actually not really sort of not treatment. It's semantics. But it ought to be able to get paid for it. I give a PARP inhibitor, and it probably doesn't matter which one of the three.
I could say, you know, maybe it's delayed adjuvant therapy. Of course, she recurred, but it's 5 months later.
Yeah.
She should have gotten the PARP, and she's getting it 5 months later. So, and so you said any of the three PARP inhibitors you'd be fine with?
I said it didn't matter. So, you know, I think we have personal preferences. I mean, I think all of us on this webinar would agree that we have the most experience with olaparib. All of us would agree that niraparib is the only PARP inhibitor that's once daily. And I think all of us would agree that rucaparib has more flexibility, 600, 500, 400, 300. So lots of flexibility. And doesn't have the same CYP3A drug-drug interactions. It does have some idiosyncratic LFTs. And so it what's probably most important is that she gets treated. You know, it probably doesn't matter.
We'll get into the issue of for how long with the next case, but just out of curiosity, assuming she was tolerating treatment well, how long would you continue it?
Yeah, so there's this misunderstanding, and we'll probably get into it, that so when we did PRIMA, it was for 3 years. You see this in the endometrial space. Dostarlimab is also for 3 years. They're both GSK medications. And there's no real reason that they did that. They thought, you know, longer is better. But basically checkpoint inhibitors are given for 2 years and PARP inhibitors are given for 2 years. And so initially the indication statement for niraparib said 3 years until the FDA realized that we really don't have any rationale for beyond 2 years. But importantly, sort of the benefit is gained in the first 18 months. So the NCI, Energy Oncology, is considering doing a dose de-escalation, 18 months versus 2 years in a non-inferiority indication. So I think most of us would not consider a three-year opportunity unless there's persistent disease, which there almost never is. It's a two-year medication, in my opinion. I can't prove it to you. I can't prove it to you that a longer duration increases the risk of AML MDS, but it probably does.
So speaking of that, actually, I wanted to present a case in a second to get into the issue I don't really remember talking too much about in the past, but I'd be curious what your thoughts are, particularly your thoughts directed towards people new to oncology about iatrogenic experiences that we have being oncologists. We're going to get to that in a second, but just to let you know that our last meeting with Dr. Gonzalez-Martin, we presented another case from Dr. Schneider, which was a patient who had a cardiac arrest during paclitaxel carbo-bev chemo on her second cycle, was in ICU for several months. It was just an incredible saga that Dr. Schneider got through this patient, went through with this patient, dealing with the allergic reaction, and made me think a little bit about the issue of iatrogenesis. Here's when we were talking about it. You know, and, you know, the issue of AML is not the first time we've seen second cancers in oncology. At the ASH meeting a few weeks ago, we talked about this press release that just came out where they observed T-cell cancers in patients getting CAR-T. Now, of course, the benefit in, you know, typical patients is much greater for treatment, but they had 17 cases. We already know about lenalidomide and myeloma, second cancers. Even if you think back, tamoxifen, endometrial cancers. So this is not the first time, and you know, so ironic for an oncologist to give a drug that ends up having a patient get cancer. And Dr. Viswanathan has a 69-year-old woman, a BRCA2 germline, stage 3C, typical kind of case, goes on olaparib, does great, and she tries to stop in 2 years, and the patient did not want to stop. So she continued. Here's what happened.
A couple of weeks ago, I did see my first AML case from olaparib. It made me sad. You know, she suddenly came in with severe pancytopenia. She had been on olaparib for, I think, 3 years and doing excellent, no evidence of disease. And now, unfortunately, has acute leukemia. And she's being managed by my BMT colleagues. She was too old for 7+3, so she's doing Vidaza venetoclax right now. She's 69. She had BRCA2 mutation, pathogenic.
How did she do on the olaparib?
She tolerated very well, except for some mild nausea. She was doing very well, and suddenly we saw this pancytopenia. And that's what got me very concerned, because her counts had been stable, and suddenly her hemoglobin dropped to like 4 after being on olaparib, and she had thrombocytopenia. So I had a hunch this is not good, and we did a flow and a bone marrow, and she had like, I think, 40% blasts.
I see she was on olaparib for more than 3 years. Why was treatment stopped?
She didn't want to discontinue.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Because, you know, she was doing so well and her cancer had been under remission. And it psychologically, it was like, I don't want to stop.
Hmm. Wow, that's not easy, huh?
And, you know, sometimes we pay the price for some of our treatments.
I think that look on her face tells me a lot more than anything else that she says. What a devastating experience for not, of course, the patient and their family, but also for the physician. Any thoughts?
So, first of all, it's really, really emotional when we cause a hypersensitivity reaction to paclitaxel or AML MDS with a PARP inhibitor. These things happen. And we just sort of have to, you know, try to be empathetic and, you know, deal with the situation, but be smart. So everybody has their style. When, you know, I would not give a patient the choice to do the wrong thing. So I say, look, this is what we're going to do. It's been 2 years, time stop. I don't talk to patients in a way that says, oh, you got an MSI endometrial cancer. Do you want a checkpoint or do you want chemotherapy? I say, look, you know, we have two options, chemotherapy or checkpoint. Both are reasonable, but, you know, I think it's pretty obvious that you need an immune checkpoint inhibitor for the following reasons. So again, it's a shared decision. So, and I wasn't part of this, and maybe this is what happened, but I think we have to be very careful. There's absolutely no evidence that staying on a PARP inhibitor, as I sort of already alluded to, beyond 2 years is of any benefit. And so, I I'm not blaming anyone, but we have to sort of, you know, be smart. And good intentions sometimes lead to, you know, difficult, regrettable results. I also want to say one thing. So, you know, we're all risk adverse, but education is the key. And unless you understand what might happen through education, you can't mitigate it. As an example, you use that cardiopulmonary arrest from a taxane. Well, you know that might happen. And so everybody in the infusion center at my site is ACLS trained. And the first thing that you do is you stop the medication, you layer on a board that you can do CPR. You can't do CPR in the chair while they're drawing up the epinephrine and the steroid. So you have to be ready. And while that's happening, the other person's getting the oxygen out. And while that's happening, someone's calling 911. So you have to know and then be prepared. But if you don't know, you won't be prepared. So it's these are just, you know, and I'm sorry, I don't mean to preach, but, you know, we have to be smart. And that's why we're here today. And I'm learning from you.
And we're so appreciative of docs being, you know, putting their cases in front of us to look at. Yeah. You know, it's just it's so incredibly helpful. You know, it's interesting at ASH, we did four meetings there, and we work with 21 investigators. This a press release that came out 1 week ago. So I got to ask 21 investigators in the faculty room what they thought about it. And everybody immediately goes, oh, well, you look at the risk benefit, and there's no doubt the number, you know, that you want to use the CAR T, and it's way, way more effective than this rare, you know, issue with T cell. But I don't know that patients always see it that way. It's not just a numbers thing. There's something emotional about taking a treatment that can cause a cancer. Right. And I guess, you know, it's just something to talk about. There's no good way to process it as a doctor. I think it's just talking to people about it, which is what we're trying to do today. All right, let's go to another case. This is a medical oncologist. This is Dr. Neil Morgenstein, who has a 63-year-old woman who presents with actually metastatic disease to the lung. Here's the case.
Her HRD was positive, BRCA was negative, both germline and somatic. She received carboplatin and paclitaxel with rapid resolution of her disease. PET CT scan showed that she had a complete response. She went for surgery and had very minimal disease burden and now is ready to begin maintenance treatment. So in this patient, which is the optimal PARP inhibitor that we can utilize? How much freedom do we have to substitute in different PARP inhibitors based upon our preference and toxicities? And then in a woman who did not receive bevacizumab as part of her upfront treatment, can we add it in the, quote, adjuvant setting with PARP inhibitor? And do we ever give bevacizumab or PARP inhibition in the neoadjuvant setting? What would the role of rucaparib be in this setting, which is a fairly well-tolerated drug? And just some guidelines as to what investigators think are the best tolerated drug, easiest drug for patients to use.
Any thoughts?
Well, Neil is tough. Those are a lot of good questions. Let's address the bevacizumab issue first. Bevacizumab, in sort of a retrospective analysis, has a 10-month survival advantage in stage 4 patients that Tewari and I wrote in the JCO. So I think it's pretty evidence-based. It's not perfect, but most people would use bevacizumab during chemotherapy. It needs to be stopped before the interval debulking, cycle 3, and also waited or delayed cycle 4 while she's recovering. So 1, 2, 5, and 6 continued in maintenance for 15 months. And then in the maintenance phase, the only PARP inhibitor that is FDA approved and can be given with bevacizumab, according to the PAOLA-1 study published in the New England Journal, now with a survival advantage, is olaparib. So olaparib would be added in the maintenance phase to bevacizumab once she has undergone recovery from her chemotherapy, which is, you know, at least a month, generally two. There are contraindications to bevacizumab. I get it. The most common one is uncontrolled hypertension and diverticulitis. History of diverticulitis and inflammatory bowel disease increases the risk of GI perforation. So we're concerned about GI perforation, hypertensive crisis, and ultimately, you know, other known contraindications, but those are the most common. So can this patient get bevacizumab now? Yes. It's a little unorthodox. I had the opportunity to first report the activity of bevacizumab in 2005. I've seen what it can do, New England Journal three times with bevacizumab. So I don't have any conflicts of interest other than the fact that I know bevacizumab works. And that's based on personal experience and data. So I'd give her bevacizumab and I'd add a PARP inhibitor. If you could get rucaparib paid for, rucaparib and olaparib are similar. Rucaparib has more dosing flexibility, has less drug-drug interactions. There is a single-arm trial that could be used as justification with niraparib. Niraparib is once daily. So I like bevacizumab. I like PARP. Probably doesn't matter, as I've already said, which one. Depending on your familiarity, most would give olaparib because it's FDA-approved, reimbursed, and has a survival advantage.
Have you or would you give niraparib and Bev?
Never. It's just, I try to follow the FDA approval. And it's same in MSI endometrial cancer. In MSI endometrial cancer, frontline, right now, we only have dostarlimab that's FDA-approved since July 31st. Would I use Pembro? Maybe, but I try to follow the guidelines. It adds to more consistent reimbursement, and people don't ask me questions. Why did I give a non-FDA approved drug when one is FDA approved?
Interesting. All right, let's go to another case. This is from Dr. El Sawai, 48-year-old woman, germline BRCA 2, primary peritoneal cancer, and he actually has an interesting question about whether he's wasting money on too much genetic testing. Here's the case.
She just presented to us with stage 3C high-grade serous primary peritoneal cancer. She had primary debulking surgery in May of this year to R0. You can see in the pictures, the pelvic mass, the mental cake are gone. And on her pathology report, they had a nice photomicrograph, so I thought I'd put it on. Of high-grade serous cancer. Her genetic testing is still pending, but her Myriad MyChoice CDX HRG is positive, and her NGS shows BRCA mutation positive as well. She's currently receiving carboplatin paclitaxel, and the plan is for PARP inhibition. And the point here, I think, is a self-criticism of how expensive we go about genomic and genetic testing. So this patient, for instance, we always get genetic testing, but this patient had a MyChoice CDX HRD, and she had next generation sequencing. A discussion about the best way to go about genomic testing and genetic testing is always welcome.
Any thoughts?
Great stuff. I didn't mention it before, but BRCA 2 patients are easier to cure than BRCA 1. I think we all know that BRCA 2. Yeah, BRCA 2 and BRCA 1 are very, very different genes. You're familiar with the different cancers that are associated with BRCA 2 versus BRCA 1. You're familiar with the different risk of ovarian cancer, higher with BRCA 1. So these are although they're in the same class, regarding a repair of double-stranded DNA breaks, they're very different. So Could I just clarify?
Because I hadn't heard that before.
Sure.
So you're saying in the primary maintenance setting, like SOLO-1, for example, did they look at BRCA 1 and 2?
They did. Mm-hmm.
And they saw better efficacy with BRCA2.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, interesting. Mm-hmm. Please continue.
So the way I do it, and he used My Choice, and My Choice is a companion diagnostic, they're expensive, and it costs the healthcare system, which is terrible, but the patient's basically never billed. So it's still bad. And so what you probably should do is do My Risk first, do germline first. And if the patient is germline BRCA 1 or BRCA 2, Myriad will not do My Choice. So they will triage it. And it says that right on the form. Now, you may say, look, I don't want to wait, and I want to order both at the same time. Then you get into this situation where you got both my risk and My Choice. But the way I like to teach it is do, and it takes time to get the tissue anyways, right? It's not like they start both tests. So you do the cheek swab or draw the blood for My Risk, the germline. And then it takes 2 weeks for the pathologist to get the requisition and cut the tumor and send it to Salt Lake City. And then by the time that is available, the germline's already done. So that's the way we teach doing it to address this issue that he raised.
So, I mean, the other issue is, do you really need somatic testing? I mean, theoretically, you could do germline, and if it's positive, I guess you wouldn't need any somatic, unless you're looking for something else. But in general, if germline negative, you are going to pick up some somatic, right?
That's exactly right. So, again, only if they're germline positive do you not go to somatic.
Right.
But you're right. And the opposite is true. Just because it's somatic in the tumor doesn't mean it's germline. They can probably tell with some level of confidence, but they don't like to. So that's why the sequencing is germline first. Anything but germline BRCA. Go to the tumor because you might have somatic BRCA, and you might have non-BRCA HRD. So, yep, good discussion.
And of course, you need BRCA for the family too. What I'm kind of curious, I noticed, I don't know if we're going to get to this slide, but in the faculty survey, it looks like people treat people who are HRD positive but BRCA negative. It kind of looks like they treat them the same as BRCA. I would have thought maybe they'd be more aggressive, proactive at BRCA versus LOH or HRD. What's your approach?
You're right, and they're more similar than different. So there is, there's more homologous recombination repair deficiency in the BRCA mutated patient, but there still is enough dysfunction in the non-BRCA HRD to justify. So we treat them the same, yes.
So knowing your history and your interest in BEV, I got a couple of interesting BEV cases for you.
Okay.
Not just you. Yeah. I see BEV kind of coming back more. I'm hearing more and more people talk about BEV. But anyhow, I thought you'd like this case. 63-year-old woman who was HRD positive, gets chemo, is on maintenance niraparib, and then progresses, and the patient did not want to take chemo. Here's the case.
She underwent debulking surgery. She was treated with adjuvant chemotherapy with carboplatin and paclitaxel for 6 cycles. After that, she was placed on maintenance and niraparib. Then 8 months later, she developed a recurrence with increasing CA125. CT scan showed the recurrence in the left periaortic lymph node. She wanted to avoid chemotherapy, so we then added actually bevacizumab to the niraparib, and her disease was stable. Her C125 came down initially, and then 6 months later, given that everything was stable, she was treated with SBRT of that periaortic lymph node. Her C125 normalized, and she's currently disease-free and continues on this treatment. Usually at recurrence, we do offer patients chemotherapy, but her desire is really to have a good quality of life and try to delay the chemotherapy if possible. So I was curious to see how the investigators would approach this, in patients who have very limited recurrence.
See,
I knew you would like this one.
I don't know her, but she's following oncologic principles in a rare tumor who now has a unique situation. First of all, cut that woman open, cut that thing out when she can go get SBRT and it just goes away. We've actually biopsied those lesions. Those lesions, many of them have a reversion mutation. And so what I would have done, adding Bev is fine, but I would have stopped her niraparib, let it wash out, give her SBRT, and put her back on niraparib. It's essentially what she did. But SBRT in all solid tumors, everyone knows, is a wonderful opportunity here. And I was getting geared up in my mind, well, this patient should get SBRT. And then she says, yeah, we gave her radiation. So that's, and again, I can't quote you a clinical trial, but it's good oncologic principles. Here is the teaching point, though, is that in PRIMA, we've learned where we did scans scheduled. We've looked and we found that even in the setting of a normal CA125, there were still patients that were getting radiologic disease. So this idea that, oh, you don't need to do scans on in active surveillance or patients on PARP inhibitors, just check the CA125 alone, that is sort of on its way out. PARP inhibitors are expensive. If you detect an early recurrence, you can give SBRT. We just talked about it. So I do CAT scans on a patient either in active surveillance or with the PARP inhibitor for every 3 months for some period of time based on the risk, because I want to find those patients, even in the normal CA125, that have low volume disease that I can intervene when it's easier. And as you know, the way CT scans are done these days, low doses of radiation. Most individuals don't use oral contrast. That was a lot of the adverse reactions is what that did to patients. Now we just have them drink some water to show the gut, and their creatinine is fine. So it becomes a cost issue, yes, but we are doing many more CAT scans in the patient that has a normal CA125 level in ovarian cancer treatment and active surveillance.
Any interest in cell-free DNA assays in ovarian cancer?
Yes. Always hard questions with you, Neil. So much fun today. We need to explore that. The challenge is that it's the rate of rise. We're going to talk about CA125, where we've studied the rate of decline. This is the opposite, the rate of rise. You know, almost all of these patients have cancer. Remember, in the olden days, we used to do second look laparotomy. We'd go ahead and do a second surgery, see if the cancer was gone after the adjuvant chemotherapy. And even when all the biopsies were negative, they recur anyways. So it's sort of the same thing here. I don't know what a true positive is, and I don't know how to intervene or how not to intervene, but it needs study. As you know, it's permeated through a solid tumor oncology. What we can't do with liquid is HRD. That should be a lot easier than trying to hassle the pathologist to send the block to wherever, Foundation or Myriad or whoever. Harris.
So I've got another Bev case for you, but before we get to that, interesting question in the chat room. I mentioned earlier, but I think we ought to just mention, bring it up now. Sarab, how will you approach patients in terms of PARP inhibitors who get neoadjuvant chemotherapy, have R0 resection, and a favorable KELM score, BRCA mutated or mutated?
So, first of all, if the patient has a really good response to chemotherapy, that patient is probably HRD, because that's what homologous recombination does, is it repairs double-stranded breaks such as platinum adducts. So I sort of want that patient who has a good response to chemotherapy to get a PARP inhibitor. And yes, she likely would be HRD. I wrote a letter to the editor based on Athena. They said, well, how come the patients that were HRD unknown, why do they do so well? And I wrote back and I said, they did so well because the chemotherapy killed the cancer and there was no cancer to do an HRD test. And by definition, it was a surrogate of HRD positivity. So I think PARP inhibitors are good options for those patients. Your other question, I forgot it.
I forgot it too. So we're both, this is actually a memory test. If you can remember, maybe somebody in the audience can remember. But okay. So, but you said something, I hadn't heard before, which Kellum. Makes a lot of sense.
Kellum was the question.
Yeah, the Kellum, because...
Kellum is a marker for Bev. Kellum is a marker for Bev. So basically, if you look at the kinetics of the CA125, if the CA125 is not falling nicely, chemotherapy isn't working good enough. And if the patient's not on Bev, then you should add Bev. So that's what that Kellum score does, is it takes an opportunity to assess the efficacy of chemotherapy alone and look at the opportunity to add bevacizumab. So it's a surrogate for bevacizumab activity.
But you said something else that I hadn't thought about before. So you're saying that the rapid response is really an indication of, you know, platinum sensitivity from HRD or HRD. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Fascinating. All right. Here's your other Bev case. So this is a 65-year-old lady, germline BRCA2, high-grade serous, fallopian, surgery, chemo, Bev, and PARP inhibitor, but she cannot tolerate the PARP inhibitor, refuses to try another one, and then recurs. Here's the case.
She went for 21 cycles, and they decided to stop. 3 months after stopping the maintenance protocol, she had an asymptomatic rising CA125. First CT scan, she had a new 3-centimeter mass in the right pelvic sidewall and nothing else. Given the significant disease-free interval and the kind of unilocular area of recurrence, we opted to surgically intervene. So we did a laparotomy and resected this mass. We retreated with paclitaxel carboplatin. She used bevacizumab with complete clinical response. After treatment, she had normal CA125 and no disease on imaging. She's been maintained on bevacizumab maintenance since then with really no significant side effects, just minimal elevated blood pressure treated with oral medications. Has been on it for 14 months at this point and adamantly refuses to stop since she recurred so quickly after stopping the bevacizumab after initial treatment, is convinced that that was the reason why the disease came back and is pushing to continue the bevacizumab indefinitely as long as she's tolerating it. So in terms of opinions, how others would handle this situation,
yeah, Tom's a great guy, not too far. He's between us, between Miami and West Palm. So, unlike frontline bevacizumab, which was given for 15 months, and where we did a randomized trial again in the frontline, 15 months versus 30, which did not show a benefit to 30 months versus 15 in the frontline. Patients who have platinum sensitive bevacizumab should be treated until progression. So he knows this. He's right on. He's doing it by the book, and as he said, she's doing great, and she could get this for a long time. And I don't know. I wouldn't even think about stopping it until I got to 3 years, which is a long time. She's only been on it for 6 months. She still needs a PARP inhibitor. If she was to recur, she could get her third platinum. And then ultimately get a PARP inhibitor at that time. Now, the exact PARP inhibitor adverse reaction has to be sort of considered. So the most common sort of acute one is nausea. And the best way to handle nausea is niraparib, which is given once daily at nighttime. And it's given once daily at nighttime with a small meal. And it's given with a low-dose antiemetic, which is also sedating, such as olanzapine, 2.5 or 5 milligrams. So you sit there and you go, I always live in hot areas. You have a little bit of ice cream. Who doesn't love a little bit of ice cream before bed? You take your niraparib, generally 200. Take your olanzapine. Go night-night. Much of the PARP inhibitor-induced nausea is gastric, an upper intestinal irritation rather than chemotactic trigger zone. So it passes out of the upper GI, and in the morning, there's still a level, but it's not emetogenic. And that almost always will solve the nausea issue. Again, it's once daily. You can't do that if you're given rucaparib, which is twice daily, or if you're giving olaparib, which is twice daily. Now, the long-term adverse reactions, such as fatigue, again, that can be handled with rucaparib because it has four doses, 600, 500, 400, 300. And again, when you deal with fatigue, it's stop, recover. You don't, and fatigue has all these different causes, sleep disturbance, depression, metabolic, dehydration, and then where I live. So if you stop and it doesn't get better, the fatigue, you got the wrong diagnosis. And for the anemia, which is also chronic, we give everyone, you know, multivitamin with iron, folate, B12. So again, education, if you understand what might happen, you can mitigate it. And if it does happen, you can ultimately intervene. Good question, Tom.
I'm looking at the case, and you're exactly right. That the reason the treatment was stopped was severe nausea, vomiting, and fatigue, just as mm-hmm. you predicted and talked. I love that idea of the niraparib nightcap. All right, one mm-hmm. more case from Dr. Wilmot, your colleague, and you've been a mentor to, I think. 75-year-old lady who's HRD positive, gets a whole bunch of other treatments, and ends up, and I just thought this was cool because we just got back from San Antonio and we're talking a lot about not just alpelisib, but a whole bunch of other related drugs. So she goes on a trial of alpelisib and olaparib. I love that thought. Different anyhow. And currently is about to start mirvetuximab. Here's Dr. Wilmot.
She opted to enroll in the EPIC-O trial and she was randomized to the alpelisib and olaparib arm. Unfortunately, at her next interval imaging, she had evidence of progression of disease on scan, as well as a rising CA-125. So she was subsequently taken off trial. At this time, the mirvetuximab label had been achieved. So she was counseled on having testing for folate receptor alpha, and she was found to be positive. So she elected to go on to mirvetuximab. She is just starting the mirvetuximab. So we'll be keeping our fingers crossed that she has good response.
What questions do you have about her case?
If you're at a site that doesn't have clinical trial access, what is your preferred regimen for platinum-resistant ovarian cancer? I'm also curious, are you doing upfront testing for all of your patients now for folate receptor alpha? So at time of diagnosis, are you waiting until they're having a recurrence in those patients who are out of the window of a new diagnosis? What sort of strategy does your office have for partnering with eye care professionals? Are you trying to utilize a select number of eye care professionals who will then become more comfortable doing these evaluations? And also, how are you making sure that the assessments are traveling from their office to your office? Is there some sort of resource nurse who's reaching out to the patients to make sure that they feel comfortable with their eye drops? And, you know, are we making sure to do continuing education to reinforce compliance with these mitigation efforts?
You feel like you're on rounds again?
Well, you said that I mentored her. It's now reverse mentoring. So she teaches me. It's one of the best things. Many of my fellows, Skander, you know, Randall, they reverse mentor me. So Cloven, but she's amazing. So the first thing is biomarker testing. Biomarker test. We've talked about HRD. We've talked about BRCA. Folate receptor alpha is now integrated in all tumor tests, Caris, Myriad, Precise, somatic testing. We're so excited. I'm so excited when I get a folate receptor alpha positive patient because it's only 35% of patients. It's a no-brainer. And now in a randomized phase 3 trial, Mirasol, done with the GOG and the European network, has a survival advantage versus single-agent physician's choice chemotherapy, so it's a no-brainer. The go-to regimen is a clinical trial, and Wilmot is elite in that regard. But outside of that, weekly paclitaxel has a response rate of 30%. And with bevacizumab, has a response rate of 50%. So weekly paclitaxel is in with or without bevacizumab. You got to be careful of GI perforation. The more number of lines of prior therapy increases the risk of GI perforation. It's only approved in the second and the third line. But good case. Eye professionals, as you know, are two antibody drug conjugates in GYN, mirvetuximab soravtansine in ovary, and tisotumab vedotin in cervix. Both require eye exams, MIRV every other cycle, tisotumab vedotin every cycle. In this country, optometrists are probably preferred. They can prescribe medications into a slit lamp, not in Europe. They can't prescribe. So we have, Wilmot and I have, I know I'm in Florida, 6 days. We have a preferred group of optometrists, and they love it. You know, optometrists fit glasses all day. Now you give them a chance to be on the cancer team. They just love it. And so they're very responsive, and they're excited to see these patients where treatment options are limited, live longer, and quite frankly, live better.
I'll tell you, they're going to be getting some more business since asthma, because we saw ADCs in breast and lung with, for the first time, breast and lung now have a drug that causes ophthalmic issues. And they're going to be sending people I think you're going to need an ophthalmologist in cancer centers. All right, I want to go through a couple things here. I mean, it's kind of basic, but we can't talk about it enough, which is really the use of primary maintenance of treatment with PARP and what people are doing. We've been asking these questions for a long, long time, and I'm seeing the answers slowly change, I think. Mm-hmm. So let's just get back to the basics, okay? So we're going to start with two situations, either a situation where a patient gets neoadjuvant therapy, which is what this is. We're saying they have a lot of disease and they get neoadjuvant therapy, including Bev, and then have an R0 resection. And now we're going to say they're either a BRCA or PALB2. You know, this is how we do consensus conferences. We ask 20 investigators what they do. If they all say the same thing, we say it's a consensus. They say four separate things. We say, no, it's not a consensus. Here, it looks like it's pretty much a consensus in terms of olaparib-bev, the Paola strategy that you talked about. And then before you comment on that, let me just show you the way everybody responds. Same situation, except BRCA wild type, HR proficient. Now, just Bev. Any comments in the post-neoadjuvant?
So to your point, the consensus is amazing. I don't know why Armstrong has been so negative about bevacizumab. She likes it in cervical cancer, but doesn't in ovarian, and you can ask her why. So I think, and Laney at Penn and O'Malley at Ohio State, so they may be counting the maintenance component of the bevacizumab. So the 15 months counts with chemotherapy and in maintenance. Right, so I look at all these answers as the same.
Yeah, same, right, yeah. So now we talk about the patient who goes to surgery first, not neoadjuvant therapy, and it gets an R0 resection. Mm-hmm, same situation, BRCA or not BRCA. Here, if they're BRCA, several people, or a couple actually, Katie and Dave, say they still want to use Paola in this situation. And then we say, okay, patient goes right to surgery, they're BRCA wild type, LOH low. And this is where you start to see, as always, a lot of difference in how people approach. You say you would go with niraparib, so does Dr. Gonzalez-Martin. Dr. Moore and O'Malley again, Bev, any thoughts?
So first of all, R0s are not all created the same. So patients that have bulky upper abdominal disease, even though you cut it out, that's a high-risk patient. So that's the first thing about that patient. You know, maybe Gonzalez-Martin and I are conflicted. He's the first author. I'm the last author on niraparib in the Cleveland Journal. I don't know. The issue here is, in this particular patient, either approach, PARP or Bev, has a small benefit in the range of 4 to 6 months. That's why there's controversy, because there's no clear winner.
I will point out, we were talking earlier about duration of therapy and how strongly you feel about going beyond 2 years to the extent that you won't even present it to a patient. And yet, two of your colleagues do it, right?
I'm just trying to teach people. I mean,
look, when people, I mean, you know, just point it out. Okay, another thing I wanted to get your thoughts on is this. Which is the question of, when would you give a PARP inhibitor outside a trial setting to a patient with relapsed disease? And you say, I think what people in general were saying, which is they haven't had a PARP inhibitor and their CR or PR after platinum, although you don't specify that they be BRCA, other people do. And right. Then you had this paper addressing the issue, which is very controversial in terms of the FDA bringing up the fact that the approach to this question of PARP and relapse disease is very different with the European Medicines Agency. Any thoughts? Yeah.
So it's really the first time ever that the FDA and the EMA have disagreed. And, you know, they're supposed to communicate and harmonize their opinions. I'll leave that to them to explain how they disagree. So there used to be two maintenance opportunities, frontline and platinum-sensitive recurrence. And the biomarker in platinum-sensitive recurrence always was platinum sensitivity. It was never supposed to be BRCA. But ultimately, the hazard ratio in the non-BRCA patients, that was never part of it, in this niraparib study was 1.06 with a broad confidence interval without controlling for any of the confounding variables. And the FDA said, yep, that's it. There's a decrement. And they removed it from the market. And then after this, they removed rucaparib and platinum-sensitive maintenance, Ariel 3. And after that, they just removed study 19, olaparib. So the best time for PARP clearly is in the front line. We've talked about it extensively during this opportunity. And if they're BRCA only and they respond to platinum, they can get it in the platinum-sensitive maintenance. And PARP after PARP probably should never be done. Just maybe last month or this month in Annals of Oncology, I wrote an editorial that basically says PARP after PARP should be purely investigational.
So one other thing I wanted to get into a little bit, we were talking about the KLM score. Can you comment a little bit on this paper looking at CA125? Actually, you pulled three papers, a whole bunch of other papers for the audience to check out. It's in the chat room. This one, and then this one from ASCO last year, talking about benefit from Bev based on KLM.
Yep. And again, I just have to brag, John Chan, another one of my former fellows. So,
Your fellow too?
Yeah.
He presented cases at the last swing. He's great.
He's a genius. Yeah, and he speaks awesome. Chinese.
He's presented some incredible cases on this series.
No question. San Francisco, Sutter. So CA125 is a very important tumor marker. Here's what it means. So in early ovarian cancer, masses, okay, it's positive 80% of the time in cancer. So if you have a negative CA125, less than 35 generally, and there's an adnexal mass, the chance that it's cancer is low, and it's highly related to age as well as CA125. Number two, that if you remove the tumor, the early ovarian cancer, and it's still elevated, it's a bad thing. Okay, it means there's cancer left. And if you give the first dose of chemotherapy and it doesn't normalize, it's a bad thing. So in these early cases, number one, you can tell which patient has cancer with an ovarian tumor. Two, what their prognosis is after surgery, and three, what their longevity is going to be after the first cycle of chemotherapy. Here, they use the trajectory of the CA125 to see if chemotherapy needs a boost. And that boost is bevacizumab. So just what it says, identification of patients with ovarian cancer who are experiencing the highest benefit from bevacizumab in the first line setting. You can go online. You can enter the CA125 into this free platform on the internet, and it'll tell you the score and interpret what their longevity is going to be. And if it's not falling appropriately, then you should add bevacizumab. And this is not the only study that's validated it.
So the idea is that you want to try to add a boost because it's not coming down. What about the patients who has a very, very rapid response? Do you treat them any differently?
Yeah, so that's a patient. So again, this is trying to figure out which patients need Bev. If they're on Bev and they have if they're not on Bev and they have a rapid response, they don't need it. Not on Bev, rapid response, don't need it.
Interesting. So, Brad, thank you so much for working with us today. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back on Thursday. We're going to dissect out hormone receptor positive breast cancer, a rapidly expanding field. I talk a little bit about alpelisib and camizestrin and a whole bunch of other new agents. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Brad.